This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week. Before we get kicked off, I just wanted to give a special shout out to Kim, Barb, and Arnie, all for being patrons of the show. And as a reminder, you can become a patron of the show. Patreon is a place online really for creators, podcasters, YouTubers, anybody really in the creative space that allows their viewers or their show listeners or whatever the case may be to participate more in the show. So that may mean bonus shows, that can mean shout outs. It's really just the support of the show. So if you want to check it out and see what it's all about, go to Patreon, patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. And also, I just wanted to drop a line about iTunes reviews. I asked last week for an iTunes review to be number 50, and now it's at 52, which is great. A lot of 5-star reviews, which is awesome to see. Certainly getting that kind of support. So if you're listening on an Apple device or an iDevice, just please spend the 90 seconds or whatever it is to go and tap write a review. It helps the show get more publicity, I don't know, whatever the right word is, but ultimately it just gets the word out a little bit better about the show. So that's all I got for you. Let's kick off the show. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast, and I am sitting in the apartment of Brad. Brad is famous on one of the TMS groups, but Brad Gutting, how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for asking. Thanks for being here.
It's cool because not often do I get to do these things on site. That's a rarity. Last week was, and there's been some occasional, but a lot of times you're over Skype. So not only is this in person, not only are you local to the Seattle area, but I am in your house.
Exactly.
Which is awesome. We're actually doing this live on Facebook as well. So we're recording this on Tuesday night, and there's a couple of people that have popped into the room, and we're going to try to not watch the camera, but we can wave hello whenever it is that we need. But, you know, I've been talking about doing this show with you for a long time, and the reason why is because there's a certain way to which you talk, and there's a certain... I don't know if I want to use, so there's a few words I could use. There's like magnetism, there's confidence, maybe there's arrogance slightly.
And I definitely go with the arrogance. I really can't deny that.
And which, by the way, is not a bad thing, especially when you're dealing with something like this. And what we're here to talk about today is TMS and chronic pain and life and kind of where all that stuff intersects. So I just want to start with, because really, like, I've just sort of seen your story in patches, right?
Yep.
As you're responding to people. So Why don't you give us the 411 on what your issue was, when it started, you know, what was the catalyst for the sort of turn in your life, that kind of stuff.
Sure. So I've had, like, I think a lot of people have had instances of back pain or knee pain, neck pain, that sort of thing, on a number of different occasions. And so the first time that I ever really had any sort of back pain that I paid a lot of attention to was in 2010. I was deadlifting and it was pretty heavy for me. And when I put the weight down, I felt this wrenching pain in my back. And it was just unbearable. And I think for the next week or so, I was just limping around and shrieking in pain when I would try and get out of bed or get out of my car. And then that went away. And so that was great. But I was always nervous about lifting heavy weights. And, you know, you and I both lift heavy weights and we're really into that. So I would have to find these gyms where I could get a barbell with bumper plates so I could drop it, because I was afraid of putting the weight down when I was deadlifting, which is ridiculous. And then I was fine for about 4 years. And in March of 2014, I woke up one morning and I just felt this slight twinge in my back. And I was like, oh, okay, I've been here before. Probably not a big deal. I'm going to go into the gym and I'll just move around, lift light, and get some blood flowing and do all these, you know, physical things I've been taught to do. And it should be fine. What wound up happening, though, was that it didn't go away. And weekend came, and on Sunday, I went over to my parents' house, and I think I just sat on the couch literally the entire day. And then I was like, well, maybe I'll sleep tonight, and I'll go into the office on Monday morning, and hopefully everything's better. Went in on Monday, and I was like, man, I'm limping now. It's like I can't even walk straight or coherently. And That morning around 9 a.m., we had had our daily stand-up, and I'm standing there, and I just couldn't, I couldn't even remain standing. So like I just like literally crouched down in front of all my colleagues, and I was like, yeah, I don't know what's going on. My back's been bugging me. And this went on for 7 months.
Jeez, okay. Yeah. This is, you said, okay, so this was 2014.
Yeah, this was 2014.
We're like mid-14. First quarter of 14-ish.
Yeah, so started in mid-March, and there was no specific trigger for it. It's not like, you know, we've all dealt with, like, instances of pain that hit you for a few days after you lift something or you bend a certain way or whatever. And this was particularly interesting to me because it literally came from out of nowhere. There was no trigger for it.
Which is kind of like the, you know, it's the, that's like the worst of the situations because there is no attribution that you can have.
Right.
So, okay. So then what?
So I was dating a doctor at the time, and she was a DO, doctor of osteopathy. So she had technically some chiropractor like training.
Yep.
And she took a look at it and she was like, well, I think you I think you dislocated your sacroiliac joint. I had no idea what a sacroiliac joint was.
As far as what I've read, everybody on the internet has done the same thing.
Everybody's done the same thing. And so of course that's followed by trips to Google and YouTube University to figure out, well, how do I fix sacroiliac joint pain? A lot of people have opinions on that. And so my girlfriend at the time tried doing some manipulations, which would, in the short term, things would feel better. And then it would go back to being how it normally was. So at that point, I was like, okay, I'm going to go to a chiropractor. And so I reach out on Facebook. Hey, somebody tell me, like, who's a great chiropractor? Everybody has an opinion.
Okay, so let's pause there for a second, because I told you a couple of months ago, and I forgot how I'd already, like, talked to you. You know, I knew who you were. You knew who I was. And I forgot how I came across the search. But I found that post.
You found that post.
You
found that post.
Because if you went back and you searched in mine, I get people from around the world that still will reach out to me about the Bankhart shoulder surgery I had two and a half years ago.
Yeah, sure.
And they'll be like, oh, tell me about this, tell me about that. I'm like, look, man, like, just go. I go back to April of 2016 of all my social media posts and you'll see it. But, like, you know, proceed with caution, and really that's all I gotta say. So okay, so continue. You search on Facebook about a chiropractor.
Somebody, I don't even know how I chose this person. I think I did. Recommended somebody who was out in a suburb of St. Louis where I was living at the time, and I checked her site and it mentioned specifically sacroiliac joint pain. I was like, oh, okay, well, none of the others like explicitly call out sacroiliac joint, so I'm going to go to this one. And so I go out there and I get the standard rundown of what's going on. Like, oh, your form looks terrible. It's just like, you know, looks like you've been in better condition. You know, how bad's your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? I'm like, oh, I don't know. I guess a 7, whatever. And then she explained how she did manipulations, is that it would be like, wind up being like a total of 15-minute appointment, and then I could come in anywhere between 1 and 3 times a week, and we'd see how it proceeded. So I would do this, and I would drive out there, and then I'd log in on the computer, and when you do that, you specify what your pain level is at the time, and I noticed from that data point that it was staying consistently around the, you know, between 6 and 8 typically. And then she started firing off various diagnoses of what was going on. So like, well, maybe it's not your sacroiliac joint, maybe you have piriformis syndrome. And I said, well, what's that? Because I don't even know what a piriformis is. and she's like, well, you have the sciatic nerve, and it's supposed to run under the muscle, the piriformis muscle, but yours might be running through the piriformis muscle. It's like, oh. And it's like, so what do we do? It's like, well, you know, we have to
fucking cut it out.
Yeah, we have to, you know, we have to use this metal tool and sort of dig at you. I can't even remember what that was called.
It's
Graston technique. And there were times when that actually felt better. But then, of course, it kind of revert back to the same thing. My girlfriend, being a doctor, was not pleased that I was seeing a chiropractor this many times, and suggested that I go ahead and make an appointment with a sports medicine doctor. So then I reached out
like to, an orthopedic.
Guy. And I knew a doctor who's also a track cyclist. I do track cycling for whatever that's worth. And he said he recommended a guy, and he's like, yeah, he's like, they gave me a cortisone shot when I had something similar going on. I'm like, cool, I'm going to go to this guy and get a cortisone shot.
Yep.
Steroids. this will be awesome.
Well, if you're cycling, if you're cycling, you should probably be doing steroids.
Yeah, I mean, you have to do some sort of drug if you're going to ride bikes. And that goes without saying. But I remember being really concerned. Oh, am I going to get this steroid injection, and then I'm going to go compete in Seattle? Actually, that was the first time I came to Seattle, was the Masters Track Cycling Nationals in 2014, and I was like, am I going to compete? And if I do well, you know, because of course I'm going to get better. And this injury is going to be gone. But if I have the steroid injection, how long would that be in my system? So if I podium in something, I get drug tested, it's going to show.
Yeah.
Well, went to this guy, and I was much disappointed, and he was not going to give me a cortisone injection. Instead, he prescribed physical therapy. He said that what he figured was going on was that I had herniated my L4, L5 disc. He had done the same. I've been through this before. He knows that it sucks, but if you get better, you do physical therapy. So go to the physical therapist, and physical therapist is really cool. And he said that my situation was that, like, while my big muscles were really strong, the small muscles were weak. And I said, so if I can deadlift, you know, several hundred pounds, I would have weak small muscles. And he said that that was the case. That didn't really make any sense to me. But whatever, at this point, you know, I'm open to getting anything done. And so I would see this guy once a week, and he would do various types of work on me, including that weird electrical stimulation thing where you, I don't know what that's called. And this would result in the same thing. I'd finish up with a session, and I'd feel like, oh, I'm feeling a little bit better. I'm getting into the car and not, like, you know, crippled in pain when I sit down and go to get out. So I must be on the right track. And this went on for a couple months, and then he was like, okay, he's like, I think you're good to go. You can start lifting weights again. And I was like, awesome, I'm gonna lift weights again.
But did you feel much different?
I was feeling a little bit. I was definitely feeling a little bit better. I was not. In terms of how this manifested for me, walking was just excruciating. I couldn't walk more than about 100 feet, 200 feet without having to just flat out stop.
Yeah.
Like, I would hold on. You know, first off, I was limping, but then I would limp, and then I'd have to stop, and I have to sit down, kneel down, whatever it was.
Like, was it like cramping, or was it?
It was like, I don't even know how to describe it. It was just, it was that sort of pain that you get where, you know, you're definitely favoring a leg. And so I was like dragging my left leg, and it would just get to the point where the pain was so intense. It's just like, I needed to rest. Like, I needed to stop.
Yeah.
I just needed to quit and just like conk out for a second. I couldn't run. I hadn't tried squatting in I don't know how long at this point. What was weird was that I could ride my bike. Like, I could ride my bike without any symptoms.
Yep.
No, that was fine. But So with this with this approval from the physical therapist to go lifting again, I went to the gym to get some squats in. I was like, I'll start with the barbell. And I was like, all right, barbell feels okay. I'm able to get my depth on. This is good. It's like, let's go ahead and do
400.
Yeah, that would be awesome. So, I mean, you might as well just go all out. I mean, see what you got, right? So I put 90. The bar was 95 pounds, and I did one rep, and I was like, oh, that didn't. That felt not good. Like there was like this full body sensation, and I felt like sore, like 2 days worth of soreness everywhere all at once. And I was like, I didn't do another rep because this is like, I gotta power through this. This is ridiculous. And I do the next rep and I just crash to the floor. Like I couldn't even get out from under the bar.
Yeah.
I mean, it was 95 pounds and I was just down on the ground and I was sweating. It was terrible. And I was like, this is crazy. I was freaking out. I was like, okay, now what do I do? I need to, I need to figure something out. So I started looking around, and I found another chiropractic group that did active release technique.
Yep, been a part of that.
Yeah, which a lot of people have done it. A lot of people have heard of active release technique, and it sounds super sophisticated. So I made an appointment.
Which, by the way, the claim on ART, if you go to the website or you do any research on it, the claim, and who knows what the validity of this, is that it can cure any chronic condition.
Yeah, pretty much any chronic condition. And so I go in to meet with this guy, and he was like, you know, I told him what happened, and he said, he's like, oh, well, you know, your mechanics are bad. That's why you weren't able to lift the weight and you got into all this pain. He's like, you have what we call muscle adhesions. I'm like, what are muscle adhesions? I have never heard of this either. And he's like, oh, well, this is when you, you know, when you work out really hard and you tear the muscle tissue, and then like scar tissue grows back, and it grows back really tough. And so it ruins your mechanics. So we need to break that scar tissue apart. I was like, all right, break that scar tissue apart, man. Let's get this on. And
there's too many people that buy that, by the way, because and I am so guilty of it. So by the way, if it sounds like I'm a pretentious asshole when I talk a lot of times about all these physical treatments that all you that are out there listening to this have done, I have done them all. And I was a big believer in ART, and then I was a big believer, you know, whatever it was I was going to try, I was a huge believer in.
Yeah.
And then eventually that wears on. Okay. So we get to the muscle adhesions, which okay, think about it like this. You have two cuts of steak, and you rub the steak together, and it's got like, it's just there, and there's a lot of friction, and like it there, I mean, just like it says muscle adhesion.
Yeah.
So that's what you were diagnosed with.
Yeah, and that's what I was diagnosed with. And he was going to break apart those muscle adhesions. Through the process of this, it wasn't necessary. I think I went to this guy four times, and I wasn't making a whole lot of progress. And he's like, you got to stop doing the sprinting on the bike. He's like, you know, the hard bike riding isn't helping anything. He's like, you're probably not going to lift heavy again. And he's like, as far as the pain, he's like, we can just work to manage it. But you're in a situation where this is pretty bad. Don't know if I can get all the muscle adhesions. So, you know, you just kind of got to accept the way things are going to be. And I was like, this is not good. It's not good. During this, I was a good friend of mine who still advises me on athletic training. Actually, he invited me to come by his gym, and he's like, hey, you know, he's like, let me try a couple of things. Let me see if we can, you know, do some lifting and do some exercises that can get you moving right, and maybe see if you feel better. I'm like, yeah, okay, let's give that a shot. And he's a really compassionate, smart guy. So I was like, yeah, let's get into that. And that wasn't working too. I bumped into the water fountain at his gym, and like, I almost fell over from that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like anybody who's been dealing with like these, you know, with these severe instances of chronic pain has probably experienced that, like some small thing that you do triggers it. Like you go to pick up a backpack and you do it quote unquote wrong. And
dude, I remember on, I think it was on Mother's Day last year. This would have been 2 months pre-Sarno, and it was my daughter, my wife, and myself, and we were on a walk. We were just walking the dogs, like taking like a very, very short hike over in Shoreline. And I have pugs, so it's not like they're very, very strong animal. You know, they're not big dogs. And, they're like pulling me along, and it's excruciating, and I'm down on my knees, and I'm like grabbing my neck. So my wife's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, all this pulling that they're doing, it's destroying my upper back and all this kind of stuff.
It's killing me.
Yeah. Because like that movie, The Day After Tomorrow, where like the world's falling apart.
Yeah. Right.
That's kind of how all the doctors make it sound. The muscle adhesions, and the piriformis syndrome, and the herniated disc, right? It's like, it's all so catastrophizing. And unfortunately, the person in the white coat, and chiropractors wear white coats, which is even a bigger problem. But is that like that is gospel now?
That is that's what you take. It all makes so much sense.
Okay, so this athletic trainer is working with you. I guess like where did the book come in? Where did the concept?
So this is great. I wish I could remember the specific site I found the book, but you know how it gets. You're dealing with something that is extremely troubling to you, so you search the internet religiously trying to find a solution. And so at this point, I'm searching kettlebells and back pain. It's like, I don't know, like maybe I need to do kettlebell swings. And like, I literally have no idea. It's like, I need to rebuild something. And I come to this guy's blog and he's talking about kettlebells and back pain. And then he says, he's like, but you know, back pain is complicated. It's like, you know, there's this doctor out of New York. His name is John Sarno. And he gives his patients lectures about back pain and they get better. And he wrote a book and it's really worth reading. And I was like, cool. So I went to Amazon and I got the book in early September of 2014. And I spent like $13 on it. Got a used copy of it. And it showed up a few days later. And then it just kind of sat there.
For a while.
Yeah, I didn't really know what to do with it. It was like, yeah, I got it. And I think that I was still seeing the active release technique guy. And I was still going to the gym with the intention of getting rid of back pain. And I started reading the book. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to do everything all at once because I'm American. So doing more is always better.
Yeah.
So if I read the book and I do chiropractic and I do workouts tailored to fixing back pain, then everything's going to be perfect.
Yep.
And as we know, that doesn't work. And you get to that part in the Sarno book, Healing Back Pain was the one that I got, where he says you have to discontinue all physically related therapy for your pain in order to make progress with this. And that is, I think that's probably the hardest thing to accept. That's where I see a lot of people struggle with it. When you read the book, when you read Healing Back Pain and Divided Mind are the only two Sarno books I've read in full. And when you read those, most people, I think, identify with the personality traits that he outlines yep. in the early chapters, because most people at some point deal with chronic pain. So it makes sense that most people would identify with it.
Yep.
And you read the stuff, it's like, oh, perfectionism and people pleasing and it just all adds up.
Yep.
And I'm like, this is totally me. He understands me so well. So that gets you to buy into it, which is spot on. And so that's great. The challenge, I think, is moving on from the early acceptance of the concept that you have a personality type that would be prone to experiencing chronic pain in whatever joint or part of your body. You know, that makes sense. It's logical that would be the case to most people to a certain point. Where it gets hard is to get to the next stage where you have to start digging into things.
Okay, so let's stop there for a second. So I moderate the TMS group in which we're live streaming on right now. And I have three qualification questions that I require everybody to answer upon yep. coming in. I probably reject, I don't know, 8 or 10 people a day, and I probably take in 5 or 6 a day.
Okay.
The main thing is that it says literally in capital letters, you must answer all of these questions for admittance. So if they don't answer any of them, it's not my fault that I didn't let you in. But most of the time, I'd say 90% of the time, somebody says, I've read this book by Ozana Trisarno or, you know, one of the greats, right? Sachs or whoever these, you know, all these different people. And they'll say, I have full belief in TMS, but they're stuck. And so you said a lot of people get to the point of the full acceptance, but it's still, there's still like, because I was the same way. I read the book. I read the back in 2 nights and I was like, this is the answer. I just need to get there.
Yeah, I just need to get there.
And I think that the getting there is the hard part. And I feel like that's a lot of the tone and a lot of the brash that you talk about online is this idea of like getting there. And so where's the missing link for people?
So for me, in my own experience, like even when I got better and people ask me, well, how'd you get better? Oh, I read a book. And so what did the book say? Like I had a really hard time saying, the book says that you're repressing rage.
Yep.
Yeah. And that is causing physical pain. Like I couldn't bring myself to say that. It felt so unacceptable to me. It's like rage, anger, scary terms.
Yeah.
And they're scary things because it's a fright. It can be a really frightening emotion, right? And I'm like, so it says like, well, like, he says that like stress can cause it. And so if you're really stressed by things,
and that's the message that a lot of people get when I talk about it is that they say, oh, well, it's like, it's stress. So just, you know, chill out, have a beer, do whatever. And I like, that's where I have a really tough time explaining. It's not, you're not really getting it.
Yeah. You're like, because the thing is that like repression by definition is things that we are holding back, mm-hmm. that we are not fully accepting. So then people say it's like, oh, okay, so it's about anger. Now I'm going to vent. And I'm going to vent my anger. And by venting my anger and talking about all the things that I'm angry about, everything will therefore click. And then it doesn't. It's very frustrating.
Yeah.
Venting,
and then you're just an asshole.
Well, yeah, then you're just venting. You know, then you're just yelling. Like, I had to unfollow this person on my Facebook feed because it was just like 5 posts a day of unbridled left-wing rage. And I'm very liberal.
But sometimes it's just too much.
But it was just like...
My mom gets like that sometimes.
Oh my God, it was just like holy righteousness. You know, I was like, this is insane. And then at one point, one of her posts before I like unfollowed her was about how she had fibro. It's like fibromyalgia. I'm like, oh, well, that makes sense. It was like, you're the angriest person I've ever seen. And so I wrote her and I was like, you need to read these books. And I was like, I'm not telling you need to. I'm just suggesting you ought to read these books because you seem to exhibit a lot of the characteristics of somebody who would deal with this condition. It sounds like you want to get rid of it. And she said, she's like, oh, that makes perfect sense. I really get it. Then she never read the books, which is also a common response too. Yeah. But one thing that I've said on the forum before is that like anger can serve as its own distraction. And when you start venting about anger, you can express a lot of outward anger about things that anybody would get angry about, politics, you know, global injustice, you know, crappy political behavior at work, any of that sort of stuff, traffic, you know, whatever else. I mean, all the stuff that irritates us. But the what all that's doing is that's just distracting you from what you're really pissed off about.
Right.
And that's where things start getting pretty gnarly. And there are two ways to divide this up, because the other part of my story is that for 4 years I was fine. But then back in March... for whatever reason.
Of which year?
Of this year.
2018.
Of 2018, yeah. Almost 4 years to the day. I was checking my logs and I was like, okay, I don't remember when it started in 2014, but like based on what I'm seeing in terms of like, because I emailed Steve Ozan, it's like, I need a session. He was like, no, you don't.
right.
And I was like, that was mid-March too. I was in the gym on a Friday. In the morning, and I was lifting not necessarily particularly heavy, I'd say moderate weight. I was doing deadlifts, and I was like, God damn it. And it's like, here we go again.
Yeah.
You know, and like I limped over to the coffee shop to get Shauna, my girlfriend, some coffee and myself a, you know, a mocha or whatever. And I limped over here and I was like, babe, I think I'm having a TMS spell because it's really hurting.
Is this still the osteopathic doctor?
Oh no, this is okay, current girlfriend, okay. Shauna. Yeah, so we've been living up here for a couple of years. And she was like, oh crap. She's like, well, let me know how you feel throughout the day and then we'll sort of go from there. And I went to the office. This is when I was still at Amazon, and it was a fine day, but like, you know, it's like I'm standing up and I'm freezing up. I'm limping all over, and some of the software development managers were like, hey, you've got back pain. I've got some advice for you. It's like, this is so humane. Everybody really cares. This is great. But I was like, no, I think I know what it is. I think I just probably need to take the rest of the day off. And so it's just like, you know, I talked to a couple of my colleagues. It's like, yeah, I need to leave. And so I limped back to the bus and then limped back home. And then Shauna and I sat around for pretty much the whole evening just talking about life and stuff. Nothing major, you know, but just sort of, you know, candidly assessing how we both felt about, you know, our lives in Seattle and how things had been since we moved up here, and maybe some of the unaddressed stress that we felt related to that, maybe some of the anger and frustration at some of the realities of living in the Pacific Northwest versus where we grew up, and so on and so forth. And then and that helped considerably. Sean is also, she's part of the group, and she's, you know, she's into TMS as well and has read the books.
Oh, awesome.
So we don't have a problem connecting on that. But there's always a certain amount of private work that you've got to do with mm-hmm. this. And so then I was like, okay, I need to think about my thinking here. And so I downloaded Ozanich's Back Pain Permanent Healing, which I think out of all of the books I've read is probably my favorite.
God. Okay. So the Bible for him is the great,
which is awesome.
And when I interviewed Caitlin Michaels, and I thought as it was coming out of my, as it was leaving my lips and I was seeing it go out into the universe, I thought it was going to be sacrilegious for me to say, I actually think the best book is Back Pain Permanent Healing.
It's so good. it's so good because, you know, it's filled with like, you kind of got to like Jung. And like, so Sean is a big, you know, Jung fan, and maybe less so Freud. I don't want to speak for her on that, but she's into Jung, and we've watched movies about Jung, and so we get into that. And it's loaded with quotations from him, which, you know, is a lot of like honest self-assessment types of things. So it's like, okay. You know, the first round I went through this, you go through, you dig into all the really gnarly details of what you're angry about. In 2014, you get into the childhood stuff. And typically what I find with most people when they talk about their childhood is that they're like, oh, my childhood was great. It was good. You know, I have fond memories of it. I'm like, yeah. Okay, how do you really feel?
Right.
And then, you know, you get into it and they're like, oh, yeah. Mm. You know, a lot of early impressions formed there.
An interesting way to put that, because I was just listening to, so I can't remember her name, but the woman who founded the Curable app.
Yeah.
There's a quote that she had that I was listening to. So I'm the same way, right? I had a very good childhood. There's four brothers in the family. I kind of see myself as like the Tom Brady of the boys, like, yeah. like the golden boy, right? You know, went to college, successful by whose standards? You know, I'm married, I've got kids, I've got a good house, sure. I'm in a good neighborhood, all the kind of like usual shit. She had said this is very common for people to have that reaction. So then she reframes it and says, okay, so think about your kids or kids to which you are close to. And think about situations when you were a kid. Was there any situation that you wouldn't want your kid or a kid you care about to have lived through? And I was thinking, oh, well, there was that time with the knife, and there was that time with the baseball bat. And it's like, not to me, by the way, this is to siblings, but I'm like, yeah, you know what? I would not want Zoe to see that.
Yeah.
And so she's kind of like, you know, focus in on those things, because even if the childhood is quote unquote good, there is impressions and there are things that are lasting and marinating in that mind of yours for so many years.
Take like Charlie Brown cartoons and how Charlie Brown characters, you know, the adults are always muffled, but
yeah.
You know, it's, those are great stories about sort of the weird isolation you can deal with as being a kid, and how just grown-ups don't get it. You don't understand them and they don't understand you.
Yep.
And this is sort of a really generalized type of thing, because every kid kind of deals with that. But there's a combination of the things that we all deal with. We all have probably dealt with some instances of bullying. We've all probably dealt with some instances of people being dismissive and disrespectful with us. And as a child, that happens, and it, you know, if it's the first time that it happens, you don't know what to make of it. Is this right? Did I do something to deserve it? So on and so forth. And so there are actually a lot of aspects of being a kid that can actually be, you know, kind of traumatic for when you're a child. You know, the idea of being born in and of itself is probably traumatic, you know, if we get right down to it. So there's a lot that you can actually work with there. And One thing I try and tell people is that, like, when you're sort of doing that mental inventory to think about your feelings and everything that could be upsetting to you now or in the past, you've got a good idea of where you need to dig is when you're going over something and you hit something, you're like, yeah, I don't need to talk about that. That's fine.
Right.
Like, no, that's exactly what you need to get into.
Yep. Because like in essence, at its purest form, by passing and grazing over it, it's repressed.
That is literally repression. It's like, okay, that you're literally repressing that
yep.
thing,
yep.
whatever it is. So, you know, I can't even remember everything that I was probably repressing.
There's a quote, I can't remember. It was either, I think it was, I think Sarno talked about it, but maybe it was Ozanich. And one of them had said, like, not necessarily the root of the TMS, but maybe what's causing your issues right now is your neighbor not saying hi to you when you go to the mailbox.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah, all the minor stuff.
you right, know. But that's the thing. But that's the thing, right? So like, say that right now, if your back started to, if you knew nothing about this stuff, and I was just a buddy of yours, and I come to your place and we're playing video games or whatever the hell we would be doing, and you're limping around, and I would ask you what happened to your yeah. back, and you know you'd have some kind of an excuse, you woke up with it, whatever. My initial thought would be like, well, what like. But what is it that actually happened? And I would be like, okay, well, tell me what happened right before the pain started. And you'd be like, well, you know, I walked down to get my mail and I saw my neighbor and he didn't, you know, it was weird. I said hi to him. He didn't say anything back. And then like, I kind of like slipped a little bit when I was walking the elevator. So like, it's definitely that little
it's definitely
slip
that
the
little
elevator.
Thing. Yeah.
When like, right. Cause you just grazed right over the neighbor part when really it's like, maybe the neighbor's the asshole yeah. and like, you're just repressing it. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. It's that sort of stuff happens all the time. I was thinking about last night, things that can make people really angry. And, it, you know, surefire way to piss somebody off is to dismiss them, not listen to them, be otherwise disrespectful.
Yep.
And we probably unintentionally do that with plenty of people in our daily lives. And then when you figure that out, then you're probably going to get pissed off at yourself for that. And you probably deal with it a lot in day-to-day instances as well. What you also wind up doing is it's when you're repressing, you're not necessarily, as Sarno has mentioned, as others have mentioned, you're not necessarily listening to your own inner child. And so you're being dismissive and disrespectful of yourself.
Simply by just not stopping.
Just not stopping and acknowledging like, hey, that's upsetting to me. And it's, you know, one thing that gets talked about a lot on the forum is, okay, I know all these things that I'm really pissed off about, and now I need to address and resolve them. And there's one guy who's, can't remember if it was Matthew or one of the others, but he's talked a lot about how he's like, no, you don't need to resolve it. You just need to be aware of it.
Yeah.
It's like, because if you try and resolve every last thing, you're going to should yourself to death.
Yep.
And that is a dead end.
Nicole Sachs says shitting all over yourself.
Yeah, shitting all over yourself. Or Albert Ellis, you know, the guy who founded cognitive behavioral therapy, would talk about masturbating. it's just like you are going to drive yourself insane with that. And that is not the idea. You
know, yeah,
that
yeah.
That is not the intended output here. But the thing is that anger is a really uncomfortable emotion. It is, you know, like I made the post a couple weeks ago. My siblings and I, we traveled back to St. Louis to surprise our mom for her 70th birthday. And I think it was Saturday night, the last night we were there, we're all sitting around together. And
this was great. The story.
And my parents had moved out of the house that that we had all grown up in. And they had been in this new house for, oh, at this point, it's probably a little over a year and 3 months or so. But the day of the move, it was like a legendarily bad day. And my sister was there for some of it because she had a wedding to attend the next day. But my mom and dad, just like the new owners of the you know, their house, were just rude and completely inconsiderate. And like, you know, they didn't understand the difference between like, okay, you own it, but you don't have possession of it. You know, this is a thing. And they weren't paying attention to that. And they're like, well, we'll just call the police if we have to. And it's like, fine, call the police, do what you want. They had their parents with them, and they all got lawn chairs. They like left and went and got lawn chairs, and they're sitting outside in the front yard, like watching my parents like trying to move out of this house that they've had for 34 years. And it's like, Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is infuriating. And you know, I've talked to my mom and dad both about this on a number of occasions. And the thing is that it's not something that you just get over in a snap. And so, of course, conversation gets a little heated, and then, you know, nobody wants to talk about it. Why are you talking about this? This is negative. It's like, I said, it's like, it's not really negative. It's just kind of like, let's, you know, let's let mom and dad be a little cathartic about this rather than try and turn off the way that we all feel about it. Because I'm very upset about how these people treated my parents. My parents are upset by how they were treated. And everybody else is upset that everybody else is upset. And it's like, this is, to me, this is normal. And it's like, this is just life.
And you're saying, like, but that seems like it's the, I don't know if revised Brad is the way of.
this is very much revised Brad.
Right, revised Brad. You know. Whereas, you know, maybe, okay, so if 2014 was the start of it, let's say 5 to 7 years ago, if that exact same situation was happening, you may just be the sweep it under the rug.
Oh, yeah. I think I'd either be trying to get everybody to shut up and move on and not deal with it, or being me, I'd probably make some like really angry comments about, you know, the people who are being disrespectful and, you know, vent and be very venting about that.
So where's the line for you between feeling the feeling? You
know, yeah, feeling the feeling. One of my favorite lines.
Got a couple, just a couple of guys with beards sitting in Seattle talking about their feelings. Just cracks me up. So where's the line of the difference between feeling the feeling and, you know, I'm angry, this pisses me off, whatever, and not getting to the point of the dwell? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I think that's where, like, I know a lot of people that are positive thinking and we're only going to think positive and all this, and like, it just makes me want to vomit. However, I understand that if they don't want to sit around and dwell about things that they're
Because dwelling and rumination, I'm not going to say that that's necessarily a form of distraction, but it is a form of targeting.
Well, rumination is depression, and depression is a distraction.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. So, and that way it is. It's like, but it sounds counterintuitive that it would be a distraction, right? Because it's like, no, I'm so deeply focused on it, man. I'm not distracting myself. Yep. I'm like, right, but. It's like you've got to feel the emotion and then sort of dissociate yourself from it. And like it becomes like this thing that's just sort of floating in the ether out in front of you.
Well, I think a lot of it is like, it's, what's your cat's name again?
Coco.
Just like begging for attention.
Yeah, Coco is, she knows that she doesn't get dinner until later. It's ridiculous.
So I feel like, you know, feeling depressed. And the thing is, like, I want to say this with a lot of sensitivity because, like, depression's a real thing.
It's a real thing.
I remember the very first doctor that suggested I needed to look more into the psychological realm had talked to me about taking antidepressants.
Yeah.
And I wasn't offended because at that point I was like $20,000 into treatment and I was like, all right, I've heard ART, I've heard all this stuff. Like, yeah, like, you know, maybe. Like,
yeah,
like, but that
absolutely.
Was like, that was like the first step of, and a lot of people I think just sort of take that idea and throw it out the window the first time they hear it. And I think like depression, maybe in a way, since it is rumination, like it's trying to intellectualize the story that happened. Like, let me give an example. Like today I was telling you when I walked in, like I had my one-on-one with my boss today and my boss pissed me off. It was one of the, like, I left that meeting as angry as I've left meetings in the past. And I think that if I would have spent the whole drive down here ruminating and thinking about it, retelling the story and like, I wish I would have done this and like, I'm gonna punch him in the face and all this kind of stuff. Like I'm thinking about it. Like there's too much thinking about it. Whereas I could just stop and say like, Mark really pissed me off.
Yeah.
And that's it. And like, that's the end of it. And I think that maybe that's the difference. It's the constant rumination and thinking of it. You're always kind of talking about the story and telling the story and retelling the story.
Is not accepting it.
Right. Which is not accepting it. Whereas if I can stop, like there was a situation a couple of years ago that really was sort of like it probably didn't cause my pain, but it was really like, all right, like you're, you know, the glass house is here and like, we're going to throw a rock through it. Like there's been rocks thrown through it for years and years and years. And then somebody's gonna walk up and just go tink. Like that one situation was probably the tink at the end.
Yeah.
But for years, really, like I mean, certainly months, I would retell the story about this guy who made me mad because he did this. This guy made me mad because he did that. But I never actually just stopped and said like, I'm really angry about it and it makes me sad because of what happened with it. Like what happened and the result of it is not really important because it happened. It's there, like it's done, but I'm angry and I'm sad about it. Like that took a long time.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to get to that point.
And I remember sitting in my therapist's office and he's asking me to tell him the story and he had heard of Sarno, thank God, like the one therapist in the North End that had ever heard of him. And this is my first or second appointment with him and I sat down and I'm telling him the story and I just like start to like weep. And he's like, this makes you so upset. Like what? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. And I was thinking like, as I left, I was like, it's because I've never really sat down and just thought about how angry or how sad this situation made me.
Yeah.
I just kept being blinded by anger, but like that's the conscious anger.
Yeah, it's very conscious anger, and it's hard to, and typically what I find that that's not happening there is that you're not accepting it because, again, like even I somehow managed to get over pretty bad back pain by reading the books and then like not even publicly saying that it was because I had was repressing anger and rage. Like, so I wasn't even necessarily fully accepting the fact that I was angry about things. I mean, maybe quietly to myself, but like you kind of got to be a little bit more overt about it to really prove to yourself that you truly do accept it. And it's hard for people to get to the point of saying like, it's okay to feel anger and it's okay to express anger. It's a natural emotion. We all have it. It serves a purpose. It's not selfish. It's not wrong. It's not harmful. But if you don't feel it and if you don't acknowledge it and if you don't accept it, that's when problems start to manifest. But in terms of how you get to the point of being okay with accepting the fact that you're angry and that you've been repressing it and that you haven't done anything about it and all these other things that can sort of like make you angry about being angry. Like I went through this cycle where I was like, oh, you know, I'd look back at my childhood and I'd resent my parents for grounding me for something stupid I did. And then, you know, I was like, I'm really angry about that. And then I'd be angry myself for being angry about it. And it's like, okay, this is getting silly. It gets really circular after a while. It's like, this is, you know, and so that was like one of my things. You know, there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of like when you turn anger inward, like this last bout that I had back in March when I read Back Pain and Permanent Healing, because so much of that forces you to go into yourself. I found that there were a lot of areas that I was having a hard time getting into. And I started looking at who I thought I was versus who I actually am on a day-to-day basis. And I would question, like, am I living my values? Am I what I pretend to be? Or am I, like most people, horrendously inconsistent about it?
Now, that's very, in the last 10 years, and some people think he's whacked, but Jim Carrey, a lot of the stuff he talks about is very that. Like you know, physical issues and depression and things like that is really like the moment when there's sort of like this clash, but which is totally the divided mind, but this clash between who you really are and who you think, who you're trying to portray to the world.
Yeah.
This character, right? And it's tough because it's like TV and movies and, you know, that kind of thing. Like they're playing a character, but in a lot of ways we are too.
Yeah, we're all
I mean, acting. Do you feel comfortable talking about the you know, looking inside of yourself about like what is this character you're portraying?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, where do you want to start? I mean, like, I don't even know
where
to begin.
give a couple of examples. Like what's, you know, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's like, I've long had this impression that like, okay, I'm this highly independent maverick renegade type, you know, pick a movie star that encapsulates that, everything from, you know, Tyler Durden, which is another conversation worth having, you know, to the Steve McQueen or, you know, whatever, any of this sort of like tough guy, toxic masculinity stuff. And so I like to think that like, oh, you know, I'm not status quo. I'm unique. I'm really different. I don't obey the rules. I'm above them, or I know how to game them, or, you know, I'm going to live and, you know, I'm going to live my life in this, you know, this completely independent cavalier type of way. Yep. And the reality is that like, you know, I wake up generally on time and I dress like a civilized person. And, you know, in the time that I've been in Seattle, I work for two gigantic corporations, you know, and, you know, I take direction and I follow rules and I play nice and I am completely civilized with people. And that would seem to run contrary to, you know, the hot-headed maverick who just does whatever the F he wants.
It reminds me of, I've got a good friend of mine and her and I feel like we'll you know, we call each other and we talk about things that like really piss us off. And I feel like that phrase happens a lot where I go, and then I did, and then I said this to him, and she's like, "You really said that?" I'm like, "Nah, no."
You know, yeah.
Like the rebel in me is like, you know, doing the Stone Cold Steve Austin and giving the guy the bird and giving him a Stone Cold Stunner and walking out of the office.
Yeah.
Like that's the way that I see myself. Like if I'm going to quit a company, that's how I'm doing
it. Yeah, I'm going to do it like this.
But,
I'm
like, ooh, but instead, like I remember I quit a job about a year and a half ago, and the whole idea was like, I'm going to walk in and I'm going to like, you know, I'm burning the place down, and I'm taking all my stuff with me, and I'm getting the hell out of here. When in reality, like I wrote this very nice two paragraph thank you for everything you did for me.
Yeah,
you
know, of course. Kind of, yeah.
And like I, you know, I walked away like, oh, God, like maybe I'm not the badass.
Maybe I'm not the hardcore badass I'd like to believe that I really am. And
maybe like what you're talking about too is this, like, you know, the independents, the trailblazers, the tough guys, the toxic masculinity, all that kind of stuff. I feel like Steve Ozanich and a lot of his work talks a lot about, like, really in reality, we're probably all pretty codependent and we all just want to be loved.
All
just want to be, you know, held. And that's really, but that doesn't align with being a badass.
No, that doesn't align with it at
all.
And
so does that seem to you now looking back, hindsight's 2020, but like, is that where a lot of that was for you? Like, is that the sticky area?
Yeah,
right there?
I think that was the part that I wasn't really fully reconciled with. Mm-hmm. Was that like, oh no, like I really do need people. And it was interesting. One thing that I was finding is that, you know, as I was getting older, getting into my late 30s, was it's like, oh, am I putting enough effort into the relationships that I have with other people? And I found that I in a lot of ways I wasn't. And so I started treating that like, you know, a job in a way. I mean, not quite that mechanically, but definitely making a point of reaching out to people, of listening when they spoke, of showing up, really basic things like that, because I knew it was important to them, but it was also important to me, and I was overlooking that. And why was I overlooking that? Because like I was so focused on being like hardcore independent man, when in reality, like, you know, maybe not.
It's interesting that it's interesting you bring that stuff up, because I think about this, because for me, like, okay, so you didn't have a precipitating moment in which your pain blasted off. I, however, did. And like, for mine, I was at the gym and I'm doing pull-ups, and I remember I had retracted my shoulder blades completely as I'm going through the full range of motion.
Sure.
And the idea was like, I'm trying to build the lower trapezius and the rhomboids and all this kind of stuff. Like if you're an anatomy geek like me, the upper back muscles, mid back muscles, like that was the goal. And then I get off that, I jump off the pull-up bar and everything felt like it just stayed in contraction. I was like, what the hell?
Yeah.
You know, to like that feeling of retracting your shoulder blades, right? Everything's pinned back.
Yep.
But instead, like, okay, well now I'm off there. I don't have to pin them back at all. And yet it still feels like they're still all.
Yeah. It still feels like it's glued.
Right.
There.
And adhesions. Right. I remember this was not long after I'd had shoulder surgery, and, I worked from home for 9 weeks after shoulder surgery. I had some problems with my dog and I couldn't leave him alone. He had some neck problems, and I was just like, I kept thinking, if something happens to him, I'm going to feel terrible if I'm not here. And I kept saying, I remember I made a petition at work to be able to work from home, and I was like, no, I can do everything I want here. And like basically telling myself, you're a lone wolf enough. You don't need to be around people. You're going to be fine, right? Kind of that forced isolation.
Yep.
And now in the last year, it's been my first actual like experiment working remotely. So like I work fully remote from home. And as time has gone on, I'm just kind of like, it's a pain in the ass to get up early and to either fight traffic or to go in so early that you beat it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, being able to interact with 100 people a day, like, it's a lot better than maybe I gave it credit for
in the first
several years of working.
Yeah.
And I know in the beginning when I first started doing this podcast, I made sure I went out and did all my interviews in person. And I made sure that I like went to coffee with somebody like once a week, right? I was continuing, because that was a lot of the Steve Ozanich stuff, was like being around people and that kind of thing. And then over time, it just became much more of like, I remember I even told my wife, okay, I need to go out with my buddies once a week. And then like it started to become once every other week, and then it's once a month, and then it's once every 8 weeks. And, you know, suddenly you're just not all that tough guy bravado. I can be by myself and that's all I need to be. And, you know, as long as I got my gym, I'm fine. When like, I don't know. Losing that human connection is really tough.
It's tough. It's, you know, and it's one of the weirdest things about living in Seattle is that like the city does have a certain population density to it. there's not necessarily a lot of interaction amongst the people here.
It's weird.
Sorry, Seattle.
Yeah, no, it is. I remember, like, really the only time. What year did you move here?
2016.
Okay, so you didn't get to experience this, but the one time where I felt like, well, two times. So Seattle to me has been very united in the last. I moved here in 1996.
Okay.
And the two times where the cities felt very united to me, and people were not like looking at their phones or passive aggressive or not paying attention or whatever the case is. The first time was after they won the Super Bowl in 2013. We had the parade here. They estimated 400,000 people came downtown to see it. Oh, I didn't see, aside from people taking pictures, there wasn't a phone out. And like my friends and I are bumping to get to the light rail to get out of Seattle.
Yeah.
And I was like, gosh, like this is amazing. Everybody's friends. And like, this is so cool. And the other time was when a local owner, Chris Hansen, or he's from here originally, had went and bought the Sacramento Kings. It was a big rally in Occidental Park, which is only about a block from where we are.
Yeah, right.
Where Detlef Schrempf and Sean Kemp and Gary Payton and all the classic Sonics were there to announce like basketball is back. And this was like the unity that like I just love about it. And then shortly after the NBA, they voided the deal and then the team never came here. But it makes me think about one of my big hobbies is professional wrestling. Every year I travel to to the host city for WrestleMania. And this past year it was in New Orleans at the Mercedes-Benz Superdome, and it's been in Dallas at AT&T Stadium. So like we're not talking about a small 10,000 seat arena. These are like 75 to 105,000 people in one enormous place.
Yeah.
And it's like you're there with this one big mass of humanity and you have this connection that you don't really get anywhere else, right? And like it seems so elementary, right? Because on the surface, it's pro wrestling, whatever. But I'm thinking like, okay, like here's an opportunity where you have an instant bond and connection with all these people.
Yeah, right.
And so much of us, like, that's what we want.
Yeah, that's what we want. And that's so frequently what we don't have. You know, I was, are you familiar with Alan Watts?
Yes.
Yeah, Alan Watts is great. And anybody who's on this forum has probably watched an Alan Watts video because, you know, he's apparently a massive alcoholic.
Interesting.
You know,
well, he talks incredibly clear if he was drunk.
Yeah, no, his speaking and his message is so clairvoyant and is wonderful, but like I don't know if he necessarily lived it himself. Of course, you know, such as it always is, cobbler's kids never have shoes, right?
Yep.
So but there's this sort of standard narrative that most middle class people buy into, and particularly in the United States, is that, okay, if you act polite and you do your homework and you follow rules and you do good in school and you get good grades and you make the right connections and you go to a better school and then you repeat the process and you do all of this, and then you get the right type of internship and you speak the right type of language and you dress the right type of way and the good internship turns into the good job, and then you take the good job and you continue being civilized and being polite and listening to people and making connections and doing what you're supposed to do and getting your good performance reviews and, you know, being evaluated positively. And then you ladder up and you keep on going and like, okay, where does this go?
Yep.
And I'm going to get the thing. At some point I'm going to get the thing. Yeah. And then there is no thing.
Right.
You know,
the thing is the retirement.
The thing is retirement. It's just like, oh, you're supposed to be dancing all along is I think the way that Watts put it. And there are two reasons why I cite this narrative, and I realize that this is mostly focused on like the middle class, and that's not the only narrative that exists, but there's a narrative for just about anybody. But that's a pretty common narrative. A couple things is that like along the line, you do the expected input and the output you get isn't what you thought it should be.
Yep.
And that is infuriating. And whether or not you acknowledge how infuriating that is another thing. But a lot of people probably don't. I know that I certainly did. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to get that degree and I'm going to get this job and it's going to be great. And then for whatever reason, it didn't happen. And it'd be very upsetting. And of course, I'd disaster it to the nth degree because, you know, dramatic and distraction. The other part of that narrative is that you do all of it and actually does all work out. And you realize somewhere along the way that you're doing this and it doesn't feel really independently motivated. It doesn't feel true. And you're certainly not getting anything out of it. And that too is infuriating.
Yeah.
Any other way, you've invested all of this time and all of this effort into it. I'm like, well, I put all this time and put all this effort into it. So I need to keep putting all this time and all this effort into it. Yep. It's like, okay, that's a sunk cost fallacy. You need to stop it.
Yep.
But you have to be aware of what you're doing, why you're doing it, and particularly how it makes you feel. how it makes you feel and be very accepting of that, whatever the outcome is. It is okay to have done all of that and to live like that. We in this culture are extraordinarily critical of people who obey the same rules that everybody else obeys. It's ridiculous.
Yep.
You know, it's just like, how could you, you know, you betrayed your values. You just led an ordinary, mediocre life. Like, so?
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing that I've been thinking about too, that I, when people, like friends of mine or acquaintances or something, when they hear that I've, you know, you've been doing this podcast thing a few months, like how is it or whatever. And this is not an award winning, but this is the award winning podcast that's never won an award. Let's put it that way. But like, to me, I'm very proud of the fact that it's been a year and I don't spend any marketing dollars. Literally, it's just the hashtags I write on Instagram and
yep.
groups that I join. But this still gets about 5,500 listeners a month in 61 different countries across the world. And to me, I say that is a great thing. And I do think it's a great thing. But sometimes people will tell me, well, why don't you just do that full time? And I'm like, well, like, it is a passion project. However, even podcasters that are getting 500,000 downloads a month, that's not their full-time job.
Yeah, right.
Because there's not money made in it. So I think that sometimes I get asked, like, you know, you need to, like, follow your dream or follow doing this. And I'm like, well, like, you know, I've got kids and the practicality behind it. And it might be, to me, like, it might be more stressful and more enraging to try and make something like that a full-time gig.
Oh, my
gig.
God, yeah.
Like, and, like, is that worth the... Is that risk worth the reward behind it? Or is it just like, this is a hobby, accept that it's a hobby, do another job, accept there's another job, and then like enjoy the other stuff that you get to fit in, like being able to ride a motorcycle on the weekends. As an entrepreneur, you probably don't have the time to do that.
You probably don't get the chance to do that. That's why, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why I'm not an entrepreneur, but you know, that's one of them, is that you lose a certain amount of freedom. But you know, we love the greatness narrative,
yep.
the heroic narrative. When I, you know, it's funny, I used to be a smoker. So I used to smoke like unfiltered Lucky Strikes and that sort of thing.
You know, I've never had a puff of a cigarette.
Yeah, you're not missing out. Don't try it. Like, do not. There is absolutely like, it is like the stupidest thing. Like, I remember my mom caught me smoking one time. I was like, shit. You know, it was just like just horrendous disappointment. You know, probably something I was, you know, subliminally angry about too. You know, and just like stacking it all up. But you know, and then I managed to quit smoking, which is kind of an interesting thing in its own right. But then I quit smoking, so I was going to do, I'm going to work out. And it's like, I'm going to be a workout guy. Actually, I think I started working out while I was still smoking, but I wasn't smoking as much.
Yeah.
Then. So I was going to work out. And I was going to work out, and I got into boxing for a while. And there was this group of guys that I would meet up with two or three times a week in St. Louis, in like one of the hood parts of town, which there are many. And we would get together. These are great guys. We would beat the shit out of each other. It was fantastic. But I was like, well, I'm never going to compete in this. That doesn't make any sense. This is already pretty stupid as it is. And so then I got into doing CrossFit, and I found the rowing machine.
But like, oh, by the way, boxing was fun.
Oh, boxing was tremendous.
Even if you weren't going to be a star,
yeah,
it was fun.
It was fun. It was a blast. And like the caliber of the guys who were going in there and the way they thought about it, and like they weren't going there to release aggression. Because you would be across the ring from somebody, and you're like, I don't want to really crack this guy.
Yeah.
It's like we're gonna have a good time, but part of having a good time is intensity, right. So you know, it's this fine line.
So then you're the CrossFit guy.
So I then became CrossFit guy. I was like, oh, this rowing machine is cool. What if I did that on the water? And so I'm gonna be a rower. Then I started rowing, and I got really into rowing, and I was getting up at how to work out. I started going there frequently enough, and there was this guy named Chuck who was in his, I think at the time, late 50s, and he was apparently, he had for a while been president of the rowing club, and he saw that I was showing up a lot. So then he came to me and he asked if I wanted to row with him. So we would do a double skull every morning at 5:30 a.m. 5 days a week. It's ridiculous. And like, I built my life around this. And then I was doing this because I was going to win. Because I needed to win races.
Yeah.
Why did I need to win races? So I could prove to whoever that wasn't paying attention and certainly wasn't going to care that I was cool or tough or, you know, really skilled
right.
in making a boat go backwards. I don't know. But, you know, it was really, really important that I do that. And so I got obsessive about it. And I actually won a lot of stuff. And that was cool. And I enjoyed that. And it was nice to get those medals. But then it started just like wearing away at me. It's like, oh my God. It's like, I'm getting better at this. I have to do this even more.
Right.
And this is so monotonous, so repetitious. And am I losing the joy of this sport by trying to win things with it all the time? And so then a colleague of mine at the time turned me on to track cycling. So he built a track bike for me, and St. Louis had this terrible track that they called Mr. Bumpy Face, and I would go out there and I started racing that, and I did the same thing. And I got obsessive about winning races. Why? Because I had to win.
Yeah.
And to prove whatever. I don't even know, but like it was very important to me that I do this. And one thing I've wondered about in terms of like what might have precipitated the back pain from an emotional point of view was in 2014, I had traveled out to Los Angeles because they have a nice indoor velodrome there. And I was going to do the time trials. And I'd been working really hard to get fast at something called the kilometer time trial. And I had done it in Seattle and I'd gotten a time of 1:15, which was good for last place. yeah, it was awesome. And I was like, I really want to get better at that. Now, a kilometer time trial, it's just like if you've ever run like a 400 meter dash, it's like that. It's pretty excruciating. It's really painful. It's one of those things that like, you know, can take you, feels like it takes weeks to recover from. And I did the kilometer time trial and I went 1:18. It was just devastating. It was like, what in the hell did I do wrong here? Yeah. It was like, what is going on? Like I had this like massive failure. And I wonder if the back pain started coming, you know, manifesting itself because of this perceived failure that I had had. But I was still trying to win races. And this just kept on going on and on and on. And I, you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be a competitive athlete, but I was like, do I even like this? I was like, this event sucks.
Right.
Like, I don't even know if I like, you know, the training for it and like all this time I spent on the bike. It feels like, oh, you know, why am I doing this for? So I can get, you know, get the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Get the thing at the end. And as you can see, I've got a mountain bike in here. And I like mountain biking, but I never really took it that seriously. It's like, oh, I like mountain biking. That's cool. And I did this, you know, I was trying to do this terrain around here. It was just the best mountain biking in the world. And I couldn't do it that well. And a friend of mine had mentioned this guy named Simon Lawton, who has a company called Fluid Ride. And he does courses for people. He teaches them how to get the most out of mountain biking. And I did this 2-day course with this guy, and I came away with absolutely zero interest in winning anything anymore.
Interesting. Why, what, so what was it about, like, was it his obsession that made you turn the opposite way?
You know, here's the thing. The funny thing about Simon is that, like, he's a former, you know, World Cup downhill racer,
yeah,
you know, competitively. In fact, he's I think he's about 50 years old now, and he's pretty sure that he's probably faster now than he was 20 years ago, which is interesting in its own right. So he does train competitive athletes, guys who, you know, guys who are competing in World Cup and World Championships, and they'll come up to Seattle to work with them. And they get better. And I was certainly getting better and faster. But, you know, I wrote Simon recently. I said, I was like, you know, it's not necessarily about getting faster. That's cool. It's the fact that, like, I feel so much more connected to, yeah, like, yeah, the terrain that I'm going over here. And all of a sudden, it's like, nah, I think I'm doing this for the right reasons.
Yeah.
You know, this is, you know, this isn't just some sort of physical release. It's not to prove anything. It's not escapist. It's not just passing time. It's really a way to experience things mentally, emotionally, and physically, that sort of triad of everything all at once.
Have you ever seen the movie Point Break?
The
original, by the way.
The original, not the remake.
I haven't, I'm not wasting my time on the remake, but.
Yeah, but, you know, I've seen it in parts. Like, I mean, my favorite part of that is where, what was it, Keanu Reeves, like, he's going to shoot him, but then he shoots,
yeah,
up,
yeah.
Yeah, shoots up into the sky.
Yep.
Yeah, it's so, an amazing scene.
So Point Break is probably my second favorite movie on earth. So there's The Dark Knight with Heath Ledger.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
yeah,
there is Point Break, and there's Patrick Swayze always puts it so eloquently when he's talking about surfing and the connection. When he's like, a lot of people that are out there riding the waves, like they just don't get it. They're just trying to be better at surfing for the sake of being better at surfing. They'll never understand the spirituality. They'll never understand the connection with the water. And it's totally how I've had a lot of moments like this in the last year or so, but like on my motorcycle, when my buddies and I are riding, cause like originally when I first started motorcycling, it was like to work and back, and that was all I wanted to do with it. And then we started last summer doing, you know, we'd ride to Leavenworth, and then we'd go a little further, and then we go to Yakima. And then like next summer we're going up to Northern British Columbia, and I fitted out my bike with all the touring gear. So it's got the GV boxes and the bar risers and all that kind of stuff. And I remember we were riding to Yakima, and like we were riding for like 4.5 straight hours. And it was one of those things where we got there and I was like, how did we get here? Because I was just like, I was so connected to the road and I was so connected to the scenery and seeing all the stuff around me that I didn't even like, it didn't even enter my mind that I'm riding on this machine going 80 miles an hour. Because it's fun and I love how it feels and I love how it makes me feel, but it's just like, I was just like, that is as in the moment as you can.
Yeah. And it's fantastic. And so there are a couple of ways I think about that. First off, it's great to have any sort of like really sort of specific outlet that's kind of got a, you know, a certain amount of, you know, glory to it, you know, as in it's an objective, it's a thing, you make a day out of it. But if you've ever heard of David Foster Wallace, I guess it's gotten considerably famous over the past few years, but in 2005, he gave the commencement speech at my sister's graduation at Kenyon College. And this is the one that starts off where he's talking about the two fish swimming along in the water one morning, and they come across an older fish who says, "Good morning, boys. How's the water?" And they nod, and they go on. And then a couple minutes later, one of them turns to the other and says, "Dude, the hell is water?" and it goes into this whole thing about, you know, basically finding the extraordinary within the ordinary, among many other concepts. But one of his points in that speech is to be aware of what you're thinking about and why you're thinking it and how you feel and why you might be feeling that way. And he talks a lot about the daily tedium of being an adult and how repetitive it can be, and how if you let it, it can become incredibly soul crushing because, well, you know, it's not that interesting,
right?
You know, sitting in traffic and going to the grocery store and listening to Muzak and standing in line for checkout and dealing with the shopping cart and unloading the bags.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, and it's just, I mean, we all do that, but you know, Wallace's point in the speech, he's like, you know, you've done this before, but you're too young to have done it day after week, after month, after year. And if you don't start exerting some control over how and what you think about, you are going to be totally hosed.
Yeah.
And he's like, but if you can get to this point of really learning how to pay attention, is that you can start experiencing that sort of, you know, shopping mall, grocery store hell as being, I think as he put it, alive with the same fire that made the cosmos.
Yeah.
Which is a little grandiose. And I've had people like visibly roll their eyes at me when I've said that to them before. And that's fine if that's the way you want to treat it. But the thing is that like I would far rather find a way to be amazed and immersed in what I'm doing on a daily basis than not.
Well, you're describing mindfulness.
Yeah, I guess in a way.
To me, because the whole idea is like you're in a moment. I mean, at the most basic level, a lot of times like meditation or mindfulness or whatever people want to call it, like it's literally just like thinking about the sensation of like your thumb and your index finger touching each other.
Yeah.
And like you'd never think about that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like right now my shoe is like partially off the heel of my foot.
Yeah.
And normally I'd just be sitting here and I'm like, you know, you didn't even give it a thought, but right now like I'm thinking about the sensation of that.
Yeah. And it's really interesting.
And it's really interesting, right? So it's like that's really what it sounds like you're describing is really just it's mindfulness, and some people think it's bullshit and but
yeah,
maybe it's the way that it's explained or that kind of thing. But I mean, I totally hear you. It's like, you know, it's living in the moment and living a certain way, because otherwise you get on that automatic where there is no thought. And
yeah, it's nothing. And it's just like, it's the automatic default setting. And what good is that? There's, I found this poem, that's been a favorite of mine for a long time, by Emily Dickinson. I love Emily Dickinson. I think her work is outstanding. So yes, you're listening to a guy with a scraggly beard who deadlifts and likes Emily Dickinson.
I feel the same way when I listen to Lady Gaga, Amy Winehouse.
Oh, I took my mom to a Lady Gaga concert a couple of years ago. It was amazing. Everybody should do that. But this poem by Emily Dickinson goes, "Pain has an element of blank. and cannot recollect when it began or if there were a day when it was not. It has no future but itself. Its infinite realms contain its past, enlightened to perceive new periods of pain. It's a little dark, but it gets to some of the truth about that chronic pain, is that it becomes formless in a way. It's like you've got it, and you can barely remember what it was to live without it. You know that there was a time when you didn't have it, but it blanks out literally everything.
Yep.
And it's just the worst. And that's why I think, you know, it's interesting is that, like, so what you're saying about this idea of being mindful and applying your mind and being present in things sort of runs contrary to what pain does, because pain is this tendency to just sort of erase so much else. All it is, it's just like, you know, when you ask people to describe their pain, they suddenly become not that articulate because it's hard to put it into words.
It's interesting you say that, because something I used to do and I stopped doing it. But when I would have guests on, I would ask them to, like, when your pain was at its worst, like, describe what it is. Was it burning, or was it tingling, or was it a this? But yeah, I mean, you're right. It's like, no, it's fucking hurt.
Yeah, it just hurt. It just hurt. It's just, I don't know. What do you want me to say, man? Like, it just hurt, you know?
Okay, so we are at 1 hour and 14 minutes. One thing we have not talked about that I want to close with is, so from the beginning, I had said this was going to be called Tough Love with Eddie and Brad.
Yeah, right.
Which I feel like we didn't get to a lot of the tough part of the love, right? It was more like two guys talking about their feelings. And so there's places where people get stuck. And I feel like a lot of times, God, I'm so happy that I put that in my vocabulary a year or so ago. Because before that, it would have been,
we feel.
But I feel like I see people post a lot of things on either internet forums or when I'm talking to people about this kind of stuff. Yep. And the overwhelming notion is, you know, I believe in this stuff and I need to go see a therapist, or I need to journal on end, and I've been doing it for a year, or I've been struggling with this for years and years and years. And I think that ultimately, like, people need to almost be like shaken. You know what I mean? Like, yep. You shake your kid and you're like, stop being an asshole. You know what I mean? Yep. So give us a couple of tips. What's the, you know, where are people missing? Are they overthinking it? Are they overshooting it? What's the, because you, I mean, you relapsed.
Yeah, I relapsed.
So, and, you know, so there was, and there was something behind that. You've told the story. And so
I relapsed because I wasn't, you know, in a lot of ways, I wasn't being honest with myself, which is common.
And some, you know, some people, like, there was somebody yesterday that, you know, they're posting like, I believe in all this stuff wholeheartedly. And, but I go and I see this naturopathic doctor, and like, it's just kind of the same thing over and over again. And I have so much empathy for these people because I was there. I was so there for the longest time.
Yep.
And, ultimately, like, I needed to, like, shake myself is really what it came down to. Yeah. So talk about the stuckness that people get, and where, you know, what kind of thing can they do to kind of get out of that? What are they not seeing or not realizing?
You know, this is tough because you're getting into that repression. You're getting into the very definition of repressing feelings. So frequently what happens is somebody says, like, okay, I'm going to read about TMS because I'm in pain and I want to get rid of pain. And so my objective is to get pain to go away. And like, well, that's not the right objective, I'm sorry to say. And it's like, what do you mean it's not the right objective? Like, I'm in pain and you said this would make me become pain free. I'm like, well, that's a byproduct. Yeah. It's like, what you really need to do is you need to do the thing that you least want to do. And the thing that you least want to do is to address things that you are harboring an enormous amount of rage about. And that means that you have to start writing down some things that you think might be upsetting to you. So if you don't do that, it's going to be, it could be difficult to get started.
So you did, like, you, like, listed this.
Yeah, stuff. I listed things out and I didn't really vent about them because I think subconsciously or for whatever reason, it's like, well, if I vent about it, then it's not going to do much good. And I had read enough of, like, Steve's work and Sarno's work where, you know, they say acceptance and awareness. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to, like, uncover things and you know, randomly.
Just think about it.
Yeah, I'm just going to think about it. It's like, man, that was really upsetting, you know, that time in third grade when
motherfucker
whatever,
stole my,
you know,
goddamn organizer.
It's just like, yeah, it's just like somebody didn't pick me for the kickball team, which is actually a thing I was upset about. So it's the first thing that you got to do is that you've got to be very outcome oriented, but if you think that the outcome is getting rid of pain, you've got the wrong outcome in mind. The outcome that you want to have is that you want to become fully aware of and accepting of your emotions. That's very broad, but that's what you're going for, is that you want to strictly think, like the 12 daily reminders tell you, to think psychologically. So that's the first thing that you've got to do, is that you've got to say, okay, accepting TMS means that I'm not going to worry about the physical side of things. I can't remember who it was. There's one guy, he's got a clinic in Los Angeles who has a method of dealing with TMS.
Adam Heller.
It's not Adam Heller. It's another one.
Alan Gordon.
Yeah. Alan Gordon. And he just tells people, he's like, okay, so the pain was worse today. So.
Yeah.
and people have said that was probably the best advice I got. It's like, that's good advice. And yep. So like, as you sort of develop this sort of indifference to what the pain is, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't correlate to anything specific. We know when you look into the science of pain, when you read the neuromatrix theory, if you want to go down that rabbit hole, and all the silly scientists who preach about pain science and completely reject TMS,
yeah,
which is absurd. You know, but one of the values of looking at that stuff is that you can start, if you're having a hard time accepting that the brain can just create pain because it wants to, like, there is actually hard science that demonstrates that it does. Ron Melzack, Lorimer Mosley, done a lot of research. Get into it if you have to. What those guys don't talk about is they don't talk anything about healing whatsoever. But they will point out, they're like, well, we know that the level of pain people experience does not always correlate directly to the magnitude of the tissue damage they have suffered in instances of clear tissue damage and associated pain. So, you know, somebody can like lose an arm and not feel anything,
yep.
You know, it's like, or you can get a paper cut and it's like literally the worst thing ever. So if you can start looking at things from that perspective, you can start accepting like, okay, I feel a lot of pain, but that doesn't correlate to the magnitude of the emotions that I might be repressing. Again, it comes down to the neighbor at the mailbox. They didn't say hi. Maybe you're upset about that. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, big deal. You know, that's not the worst thing. So you've got to work on accepting that, and you've got to work on accepting that anger is okay. I'm here to tell you it's okay to get angry. It's okay to feel angry. It's okay to be angry at your mom, your dad, your brother, your sister, whoever.
Your kids.
Your kids. That is a major one for new parents. Oh my God. That is one of the hardest things that anybody, I mean, I don't have kids, so I can't know what that's like.
It took me 6 months of therapy to say.
I remember your post about that.
It took me 6 months of therapy to literally say, Zoe makes me upset sometimes.
Yeah, Zoe makes me sad. And it's like, yeah, they'll do that. You know, kids, like, they are totally dependent on you, and yep. That is very upsetting to somebody who doesn't want to be responsible.
Yep.
And that's okay. It's okay to feel that. It is not okay, of course, to abandon your child and to abandon, you know, responsibilities of something that you started, and that's something you got to reconcile if you disagree with that. So it's getting into thinking away from the physical. If you go into reading the books, I'm going to read this book to make the pain go away, you're going to be very disappointed.
Well, because it's counterintuitive to the thing psychologically anyway.
Yeah.
Because if the thought is, yeah, I'm going to read this and the outcome will be the pain's going to go away, it should... You're saying that it should be, I'm going to read this and discover more about myself.
Yeah, I'm going to discover more about myself, and I'm going to discover more about how I actually feel and learn how to accept it. And you know, I see people say, it's like, well, everybody's got their own journey to doing this. I'm like, yeah, but sometimes that journey like goes in a lot of circles.
Yeah.
And like, I see people seeking out the same advice. And that's okay, too. I told somebody recently, it's like, you know, you're dealing with a lot of gnarly bullshit. Like, you got every right to be upset about this. It's like, you don't need to get advice about it. You need to realize that the advice seeking is probably just a diversionary tactic that you've got.
Yeah.
And go ahead and engage with how you're feeling. It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's the advice. Pay attention to that and then, like, go and do it. Because otherwise, you know, some of the words that people write, like, I mean, Steve's books are great. Like, I love reading those. A lot of Sarno's essays are really compelling too. You can get kind of lost in that. It's like, okay, now your objective has become reading about TMS, reading theories, reading science.
Memes on the internet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, memes on the internet. Great. you're reading about this, and then you're talking about yourself and your feelings. And yeah, you need to do that, but you want to not be lingering on this.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of the things that mystifies me about, like, the painscience.com is, you know, those guys are borderline hostile towards Sarno's work. And one of the great ironies for me is that, like, the guy who runs Pain Science, I don't know if he's still dealing with, but he confessed to have been dealing with a lot of chronic pain. And I'd read on one of the forums that Lorimer Mosley had been dealing with chronic pain, and neither one of them would respond to anybody who said anything about Sarno.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, they completely dismiss it. I've had scientists, friends of mine, be completely dismissive of it. I'm like, look, it's like, theoretically, I know it doesn't obey the right protocols, and that there's a lot of reasons why you won't believe it because it doesn't fit the scientific norm, and that's fine. But, like, you got to look at the reality here, man.
Yeah.
it's getting to that reality, read testimonials, listen to my testimonial that I gave here, the other ones that are on Eddie's podcast, read the ones on the TMS wiki. There are a lot of stories out there. Whatever you're dealing with, there's probably something that comes pretty close.
As far as the writing part of it, because a lot of, you know, journaling is one of the major, I'd say, like, journaling and meditation are probably two of the more popular self things. You can go see a therapist, but I mean, things you could just do by yourself.
Yeah, things you can do yourself. Yep.
So your method, this is interesting. This is the first time that I've heard this. Sarno talks about it as step one and a two-step thing. He says, make a list and then write about the list.
Yeah.
You just did the list.
I just kind of did the list.
And maybe that's why, like, you know, you make it crowded in your own headspace if you go with the tactic of, I'm just going to think about it.
Yeah, you can.
Especially, you know, if you're like, I'm not old by any means, but I'm 32, right? So, like, a lot of stuff has happened. And if I try and think about particular events or things that I'm angry about, I feel like that could kind of easily get lost in the headspace.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe writing it down, putting it on paper sort of forces you to be more introspective.
It makes it at sort of like somewhat of a dissociation. Like, you know, when you meditate, you know, there are a lot of different ways that you can go about meditating, but, you know, if you use the Headspace app, which is as good as anything to start with, you know, that guy talks about, like, you kind of watch your thoughts and feelings like it's just cars passing on a road. You know, it's like, oh, it comes in. It's like, look at that. And then it kind of goes out.
You know, Dr. Hanscom said in the podcast we did together, we did it at the Washington State Athletic Club back in July, and he had said that there was something like over 1,000 studies that were done that talked about how that surgery does nothing for chronic pain. There's like 1,000 studies on this.
Yeah, tons. Sure.
But that expressive writing relieves chronic pain. And he had said that there was a dissociation between putting it on the paper and, like, as opposed to thinking about it versus writing it down, that disassociation happens. And there's something in the neuroplasticity where it disassociates, as you said.
Yeah, it's so weird. I don't know what the mechanism behind it is. Again, I can't prove this stuff with double-blind peer-reviewed science. and that's the thing, is that, like, you know, I like science, you know, and kind of don't have a choice, right? you know, it's true whether or not you believe it. And what's so difficult about this is that, like, there is that sort of, like, well, it's like, yeah, but it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit what the experts say you should do to validate things, so I can't believe it. I'm like, well, okay, it's up to you. And I understand the hesitation there, but then you've got to make a call. Like, do you want to just be theoretically right, or do you want the real world results?
Yeah. Okay. Well, this has gone way longer than I thought it would. But but Brad, I'm sure that we are going to do this again. This is an area that I love coming down to visit, and so I obviously don't have any issues coming down here. Any departing words or thoughts?
Any departing words or thoughts? I mean, bluntly, you can do it. Like, Roadhouse, Dalton. Hopefully, I'm not the only one who's seen that, listening.
I've never seen it. Well, it's one of my wife's favorite movies, and when she hears it,
it's fantastic. He's got this great line, pain don't hurt. It's just like, there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with your back, or your knee, or your wrist, or your ankle, or your neck. There's not. In all likelihood, if you've been dealing with this for 3 months, whatever tissue damage might have been there is healed. You're going to be fine. And it is okay to feel those feelings of rage and anger and frustration. It's okay. Believe me, it's okay. Feel them. Don't run away from those feelings. And it's going to be okay.
Feel your fucking feelings.
That's right.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.